Thank you and good afternoon. Gregory Lansky, registration number 38515 from Mr. Joseph Ward. Mr. Joseph Ward was convicted after a jury trial of one count of a sexual assault on a child. This appeal concerns the denial of his 35C motion, his post-conviction motion. Briefly, regards to the facts, the state alleged that the child, DB, on one of the last days of fourth grade, was on the playground with her two friends, and she alleged that she was molested over 2.5 years ago. Subsequently, my client, Mr. Joseph Ward, was arrested, although he only met, it was alleged he only met the child, DB, only on one occasion years ago. With regards to the first claim that was raised on my appeal concerns the issue of the jury instruction error. The post-conviction court indicated that they did find deficient performance by appellate counsel in this issue. And mainly the jury instruction error was that the mens rea was not included in the definition of sexual contact. The post-conviction court declined to find prejudice because the court indicated that the burden was set higher because the incorrect mens rea intentionally was higher than the statutory mens rea of knowingly. In addition, the post-conviction court denied on prejudice grounds on the basis that the defense really didn't concern the mens rea. The defense was the fact that this never did happen. This happened years ago. And essentially, the defense during trial was attacking the credibility of the alleged victim at trial. With that said, I submit to the court that the court's post-conviction or Strickland analysis was erroneous. I think the law here in Colorado is pretty clear when it comes to mens rea. Specifically, I think the cases of I think Hardin, Mathis, and Archuleta all indicate if there's an error with regards to the mens rea in the jury instruction, there's no additional analysis with regards to whether or not it was contested at trial or not. The court has a basic and inherent duty to properly instruct on the elements of the crime at trial. And the fact that the court did not do that basic duty, my client, in effect, was convicted of a non-existent crime because there was no crime with that mens rea. And because of that, if this would have been raised on appeal, it would have amounted to plain error. And I think the Supreme Court precedent indicates that this is the case. And in fact, I believe in the case of People v. Caldwell that Your Honor, Justice Casebolt had authored, I think you indicated the same, that you followed the decision, Supreme Court decision in Mathis, and said if it's improper mens rea and the other instructions don't clearly show what the proper mens rea was, then that amounts to plain error.
Well, the problem in this case, as I understand it, is that the elements were properly stated in the elemental instruction, but it was the definition of sexual contact that had the erroneous mens rea, correct?
That's correct, but that's an element. That's an element of the crime.
But in terms of the element, knowingly was set forth in the elemental instruction itself.
Absolutely.
Okay. So the instruction on sexual contact said intentionally.
Correct.
Wouldn't the combination of knowingly and intentionally require then that there be a higher standard for your client to set the prosecution had to satisfy that burden?
Well, the problem with this situation is that intentionally was not defined elsewhere in any of the instructions. So the issue is that the jury could have done their own individualized, subjective, non-legal definition of intentionally. We don't know what they did for the mens rea for sexual contact. And that's the problem. We don't know. I mean, it just was not the proper legal definition. And I think if my client was serving a 6-year to indeterminate life sentence, I think it's essential that the court properly instructs on the mens rea for the charge that he was convicted of. And that was not done in his case. And I believe, pursuant to the Colorado Supreme Court precedent, I believe this would have amounted to plain error, because none of the other instructions that were given to the jury in Mr. Ward's case defined intentionally. And what that means is that the jury could have came up with their own definition of intentionally. And I think, at the minimum, the due process requires that each element be proved beyond a reasonable doubt, And in fact, that did not happen in Mr. Ward's case. The fairness was of his trial is in doubt. And the Strickland, second prong of Strickland is whether or not the confidence is undermined in the appellate, in the appeals. I don't necessarily have to show whether the result would have been different. What we have to show is whether the confidence was undermined. And I believe, based upon Supreme Court precedent, and based upon the fact that, you know, this would amount to a plain error, that in fact that the confidence in the appeal is undermined here. I think we met our burden here. I understand the people in their answer brief, they cited to Court of Appeals cases, and they indicate that if it's not contested, then it's no plain error. Or if the evidence was overwhelming, it's no plain error. But again, you know, you're comparing Court of Appeals cases with Colorado Supreme Court precedent. If there's any tension between them, Colorado Supreme Court precedent is going to prevail. I'm asking the court to follow that precedent.
Mr. Lansky, I think they also cited Griego, if I'm not mistaken. Griego was a Supreme Court case. And I think Griego dealt also with a similar situation. The trial court didn't define the mens rea of knowingly for the jury, but the Supreme Court said that the error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt because the jury assumedly applied the commonly understood meaning of the mens rea term. So there was no definition given there either. And that's a Supreme Court case. They said it was harmless.
Right. What? And I don't recall specifically what the Griego case said. But I know, you know, I don't know whether the other instructions in that case applied knowingly or not, or whether, you know, whether or not the jury could have seen other instructions from that case. Again, I don't know the facts specifically of the Griego case. But I believe the other cases are still good law with regards to, you know, regards to the error in mens rea. And I don't think those cases are considered bad law. But I know for the cases that the people cited with regards to the Court of Appeals cases, Romero and also, I think, Clausen, I think our case is a little distinguishable because in Romero, I think actually the knowingly instruction was provided, but it wasn't provided fully. In regards to Clausen, the issue is that the issue of contesting that element, that element, you know, in Mr. Ward's case, I mean, in that case, Clausen, they actually sort of conceded that issue. That case, you know, that element was essentially conceded. Mr. Ward's case, that element was never conceded during the trial process.
And well, but Mr. Ward's defense was, it wasn't me.
Right, correct.
His defense was, it didn't happen or it wasn't me. Did he ever say whoever it was didn't commit this crime knowingly?
Right. But I think the thing is, the burden is on the people to prove all the elements of the crime. The burden is not on Mr. Ward to prove his defense. He can remain silent during the trial. And the fact of the matter is that the people did not prove every element of the crime beyond a reasonable doubt. If you're going to go into an analysis where you're going to see whether or not Mr. Ward had contested this specific element, you're essentially, what you're doing now is you're switching the burden to Mr. Ward. And I think it's clear that due process clause indicates that. No, the burden does not switch. The people always have the burden to prove each element beyond a reasonable doubt. And I submit that was not done in Mr. Ward's case. And just go to the next argument with regards to the social service records and the school records for in-camera review. Mr. Ward indicated that he indicated that it was ineffective assistance of appellate counsel for not raising this issue on appeal to ask the court to review the Department of Social Service records and the school records. Clearly, the district court before trial did review these records, but indicated that there was nothing there that should have been provided to the defense. The post-conviction court, when deciding this claim, indicated they were equivocal as to whether or not this amounted to deficient performance. It was decided on the basis that prejudice was not shown. But we submit to the court that the prejudice could not have been shown because the post-conviction court never gave us any access, you know, to the DSS of school records. So it was improper for the post-conviction court to deny on prejudice grounds when we specifically requested an in-camera review by the district court, by the post-conviction court. It was not done, and then they denied on prejudice grounds. I think in a situation like this where the court just mentioned the issue was that Mr. Ward did not do it. There's all credibility issues here. And there was issues with regards to, raise that trial, regards to foster care, regards to, issues whether could she be making it up, was she asking for attention. I think whatever was in those records, if there's any records that indicate anything involving her life with her mother, because she was living with the grandmother at a time, or anything to give her motivation not to go back with her mother, if there's any DSS or school records about that, or any credibility issues, that's something that should have been, I think disclosed to defense before trial. It could have affected their defense in regards to how they're going to frame the defense, what their strategy was. We don't know what's in those DSS records. We're asking the court to conduct an in-camera review pursuant to ADT and JAL, and I believe People v. Frost. There's three criteria where the court should review these records. One is whether or not there's any Brady material, whether impeachment or exculpatory material in these records. Number two, is there any materials that would have been materially assisted the defense in this case? Was there any other materials with regards to whether it would have been discoverable pursuant to Rule 16? And we're asking this court to conduct an in-camera review of these DSS and school records, and to let us, and if anything should have been disclosed, to remand it back to the post-conviction court to give Mr. Ward the opportunity to show that if these records were disclosed, there would have been a reasonable probability the outcome would have been different. With that, I would reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Patricia Van Horn, registration number 30,002, and I represent the people on this matter. As to the post-conviction court's ruling about the jury instruction, the court properly resolved the claim because the defendant failed to show that appellate counsel was ineffective for failing to raise it. The fact that the definitional instruction contained intentionally instead of knowingly, he failed to show how that prejudiced him, particularly in this circumstance where his defense was not that I touched her, but it was not for a sexual purpose. His defense was she's fabricating her allegations. As to the post-conviction court's resolution of the school records, he had to show, in order to show that appellate counsel was ineffective for failing to raise this claim, appellate counsel would have had to have shown that the trial court abused its discretion when it ruled that these records contained nothing relevant. And he didn't make any kind of offer of proof or any showing that the district court's ruling, the trial court's ruling, was wrong. And he didn't show why this issue would have been stronger than those issues appellate counsel chose to raise.
Ms. Van Horn, concerning proving abuse of discretion, how would defendant do that given that the post-conviction court didn't review those records?
He could have made an offer of proof if he thinks somehow, he's speculating at this point that the district court was wrong when it ruled that these records contained absolutely nothing relevant. And this court can, on appeal, look at those records and determine, well, it's a two-part test. Now you have to determine, or three, whether the court was wrong when it made that ruling, whether it abused its discretion, and then whether appellate counsel, this issue would have been greater than the issues appellate counsel raised, and therefore appellate counsel was deficient for not raising it.
Well, some of those portions of that three-part test that you're articulating require some fact-finding.
Correct.
And we're not a fact-finding court. So
correct.
Is it appropriate to remand to the post-conviction court so it can take a look at these records and make a determination based upon its fact-finding obligations?
I don't know that a remand is necessarily required because I think he had to have something more to show that appellate counsel should have known that there was an issue here. And I honestly don't know what that would be.
Well, he did make an offer of proof. I think there were seven or eight different categories of areas that defendants said there might be records pertaining to these specific things. So he made an offer of proof. He had no access to the records. How's he going to show what the records say to support it? He's relying on the trial court.
To say that, no, none of this information is contained.
Right, and then in terms of review, he didn't get appellate review of that. What he asked for and got was post-conviction hearing. But if the trial, if the post-conviction court didn't look at it, I mean, don't we lack something here?
I agree that we lack something, but I think there has to be something more than to speculate that there was something that appellate counsel should have done, given the other claims appellate counsel raised, and I don't know exactly what that is. It seems to be there's a piece missing here. Because what we're looking at, okay, here are the issues appellate counsel chose to raise. She chose not to raise this particular issue. And I recall from her testimony, she couldn't remember why or if she'd looked at that or not. But we have to assume, I mean, the presumption is that she, her performance was reasonable and professional. So that's the presumption that he has to overcome. And as to just the general claims, this post-conviction judge made almost 30 pages of findings on each and every claim where it found reasonable strategic decisions and cited back to the testimony of Mr. Wirt's two trial attorneys. And so those are all supported by the record. If this court has no other questions, I'd ask that the order be affirmed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If I may. Judge, just getting back to the court's question of regards to, I think the site was Greco.
Griego.
Mm-hmm. No, I just looked over the people's answer brief. I don't think they cited that. That's why I was a little, I wasn't prepared as I would want to be, you know, to that court site. So okay. I don't know whether I could distinguish that case or not. I just know the people did not cite that. They only cited Court of Appeals cases.
Okay.
With regards to the other claims, first let me just go back to the presumption that the people were just arguing about the appellate counsel. The post-conviction court did find deficient performance, you know, of appellate counsel, you know, in the very least as to the erroneous jury instruction. So there was a finding in regards to appellate counsel, and I think the presumption, you know, is not present in this situation. Let me just briefly touch on some of the other issues that I raised in the motion and on the appeal. I think the interesting issue is the issue with regards to the forensic interview tape of DB in this case. And specifically the confrontational clause claim, how the appellate counsel should have raised this on appeal. Yes, DB did testify at trial. And yes, the video was over an hour and 8 minutes long. The questions that were asked to DB during her examination at trial only did a very partial part of that videotape. When she testified, it wasn't clear whether this video would be admitted or not. There was issues whether it would be cumulative. So there was no decision on whether or not the video was going to be entered at the time DB testified at trial. Two other witnesses testified after DB, and then only at that point does the prosecution play these 1 hour and 8 forensic interview to the jury. After that, DB was not recalled by the prosecution. I submit to the court that this is a Crawford violation. The people, pursuant to Melendez-Diaz, the United States Supreme Court case, had the obligation to reproduce DB because there was hearsay statements in this video which were not subject to cross-examination when she initially testified.
Well, defense counsel had the opportunity to cross-examine her and did, right?
But that was before the video was shown, Your Honor. And at that point, defense counsel did not know whether or not the video was going to be played. So they're not going to cross-examine her to, let's say, you know, harmful material when they know, hey, this harmful material may never have been, you know, given to the jury.
Right.
Once the prosecution subsequently made the determination they're going to play this 1 hour, 8 minute video, then it was upon their responsibility, their burden to reproduce VB, so then she can be adequately and properly cross-examined with regards to her statements contained on the video. That was not done in this case. And in this case, and if this would have been raised on appeal, this Crawford issue, this confrontational clause issue on the United States and the Colorado Constitutions, I submit, you know, there's a reasonable probability that the outcome of the appeal would have been different. I think the confidence is undermined on the appeal process, because I think clearly there's a Crawford violation here. Now, with that,
May I ask a question?
Sure.
Counsel, wouldn't it be reasonable to assume that in preparing cross-examination of DB, defense counsel, though, would have anticipated her testimony to be inclusive of what she had already stated in her video and therefore have been prepared to cross-examine her on those issues?
Okay, initially, I know my time is up.
Go ahead, answer the question, sure.
But the problem here, Your Honor, is it was a strategic decision. And the situation is that defense counsel did not know whether the video was going to be played or not. So why, I mean, as a defense counsel, you would not want to bring in inculpatory or harmful material if you know that material would not be given to the jury at a later time. So the fact that there was no determination that this video was going to be admitted, and the people chose in their order of their witnesses to present first DB, and then later after many other witnesses to show the video, then defense counsel is not going to start questioning everything about the video, especially harmful stuff, because they don't know if that harmful stuff is ever going to be, the jury is ever going to be exposed to the harmful stuff. So you can't leave it on defense counsel to ask them questions when they don't know that this material is ever going to be presented to the jury. And that's why there's a Crawford violation, a confrontational clause violation in this situation.
So you're arguing that the strategic decision that defense counsel made was ineffective assistance?
No. I'm not arguing effective assistance of trial counsel. I'm arguing effective assistance of appellate counsel. What I'm trying to explain is that the reason why this is a Crawford violation, because if the defense counsel doesn't know that this harmful material is going to come into trial into evidence, either because the DA is going to choose not to do it or the court's not going to allow it, pursuing an objection, because there was an objection to this video as a cumulative evidence, then they're not going to ask questions about this harmful material, of this inculpatory material, with this witness. And the fact that they then subsequently introduced this video, which has all this harmful material and all this inculpatory material, then it's upon the DA, the prosecution, to recall this witness and allow defense counsel the opportunity to cross-examine this witness with all this new harmful and inculpatory material.
What, if anything, prevented defense counsel from recalling the victim?
The problem is, if you look at United States, Melendez Diaz, the case I cited in my reply brief, it's not upon defense counsel's obligation to produce this witness. It's the prosecution's burden. And they chose to present the witnesses in this order, and it's upon them to then reproduce, to recall this witness, so this witness can be subject to cross-examination to all this hearsay statements that were in this 1 hour and 8 minute video. And to have the defense counsel recall this witness during their case, it's going to look bad upon them to recall this child witness. And so I don't think it was in their interest. It would have been counterproductive to do it. I don't think it would be in their interest. It would have been bad to show the jury to do it. And I submit it, the prosecution was responsible for their order, for their presentation of the evidence. And they chose to do it this way. And pursuant to the United States Supreme Court precedent, they had an obligation to recall this witness to subject her to cross-examination. And with that, if any more questions? Okay.
Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments this afternoon. The case will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion in due course.